let's now kick the session off. In June, EPA held its National Association of Remedial Project Managers meeting in Atlanta, Georgia, and one of the most attended sessions was on green remediation. Because of its success, the members of the EPA's Technical Support Project, led by the Engineering Forum, have taken this full-day session and are bringing it back as online seminars, and this is the third of the three sessions. And before I turn it over to first of our three speakers, again, I would like to remind the participants to put your phones on mute. If you don't have a mute button on your phone, hit *6, and please do not hit us on hold. Today's first speaker is Timothy Reeder, and he is a senior technology advisor in EPA Region 8 in Denver in the Ecosystems and Remediation Program. He's also the Region 8 Green Remediation Coordinator and co-lead for the Region 8 Green Building Team. He is the lead accredited professional. Previously, he was the remedial project manager for the Denver Stadium site and Rock Flats Nuclear Weapons Facility. He was also the on-scene coordinator for various projects. Today, he will give us an update on Region 8 activities. Welcome, Timothy.
Thank you. Thank everyone who's on the phone. I'm going to go briefly in 10 minutes a number of the activities we have going on in Region 8. The first slide, that acronym is Renewable Energy on Contaminated Lands in Region 8. The slides or the photos you see on that first slide are all good projects of where renewable energy has been sited on contaminated lands in Region 8. The wind turbines are at a former shooting range at Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming. The landfill gas project is here in Denver at the Denver Arapahoe Disposal Site. And the solar array is over a 2-megawatt solar array over an old landfill at Fort Carson Army Base in Colorado Springs. These are all good sites, and I'd be pretty excited about them, except that EPA really didn't have much to do with them. However, we have some sites in the works, or some projects in the works that are worth talking about. Go to slide 2, please, and most of you on the call understand these things, but a couple of highlights or the bullets that I really emphasize when I'm talking to managers and other interested parties about renewable energy on contaminated lands is, of course, the first one. We need to site an awful lot of renewable energy if we're going to combat global warming. But then the second to the last one, renewable energy, we believe in a number of our sites can be significant in reducing our long-term operation and maintenance costs. And that's certainly an issue, I'm sure it's an issue nationally, but here in Colorado, the state officials have told us they don't want to start work on new mine sites that look like it might have long-term treatment obligations just because they can't afford it. But potentially there's some, we think, renewable energy systems can decrease that long-term operation and maintenance burden. The bottom one, I'm sure everyone's aware, but certainly a lot of the large mining sites we have in Colorado, we have significant transmission in addition to roads. We have a significant amount of infrastructure there already. And often the lack of infrastructure is what precludes renewable energy projects from getting going. Slide 3, please. Then just the last of these that I'll hit on is that we believe that siting renewable energy on contaminated sites, especially EPA contaminated sites, could be a great way for the agency to reduce its environmental footprint. I know that some of the regions are considering the idea of doing green power purchases, for instance, to offset their carbon emissions at Superfund sites or emergency response cleanups. And here in Region A, I think we're a little bit leery of the whole green power purchasing market, and we really are searching for ways to find on-site renewable energies to do this work or to do that offset. Next slide, please. This is a basic educational slide I like to put in when I'm talking to student groups because we tend, as a society, to interchangeably use the words power and energy, and in these renewable energy projects, it's sometimes important to make sure you understand the distinction. But it would take a kilowatt of power to light 10 100-watt bulbs. It would take a kilowatt of power over an hour, a kilowatt hour worth of energy to light those bulbs for an hour. On to slide 4, or the next slide, which is 5, I guess. Yeah, 5. This is the Summitville mine in southwest Colorado, arguably one of the biggest environmental disasters in Colorado. You can see the pond in the foreground. That's a holding pond where water that's draining out of the mine adit and off of the mine tailings, the contaminated water is held and then batched into a treatment plant, which is a very tiny building you can see in the foreground, the lower, just upstream of the pond. We treat about 1,400 gallons per minute of contaminated water there. The electricity costs are a big part of the ongoing maintenance and operation of that project. And we, and then at some time the state, will be treating water there for basically forever. So we are building a hydro plant. Next slide, slide 6. The picture is the penstock. So upstream of that pipe is an inlet structure that intercepts water from the creek that that runs adjacent to the site, puts it into the pipe, and then after this summer there will be a powerhouse down on that foundation you see, and a 50 kilowatt Pelton wheel hydro plant. And we expect that to be in place by, well, June or July of the summer. And that's going to offset a large amount of the electricity needed to operate our water treatment plant. Just a little background on this. It was some of the excavation needed to install the penstock was in a tight location through some very hard bedrock. So this is going to be a fairly expensive project, probably around $1 million. And when you divide that out on a per watt basis, it's about $20 per watt. And some may think that that's outrageous when you think that you can put $8 a watt, you can put a solar array on your roof. But the capacity factor of this system will be about, close to 100%, whereas the capacity factor on a solar array is here in Colorado, where we have a sunny state, it's only about 17%. And, let's go to the next slide. That'd be slide 7. Slide 7. The Anaconda smelter site. Here, another large mine site. This is near Anaconda, Montana. And we have, we just 3 weeks ago installed a 60-meter met tower at this site. The tower you see in the picture has an anemometer every 10 meters on the tower, and we will be collecting wind data. This is the site where the county of Anaconda is really interested in redevelopment, and we're helping that along basically by collecting wind data. The National Renewable Energy Lab regional maps say that this is in the highest class wind you can have. However, no bank will lend money on a project, a wind development project, unless you have on-site data, and most of them want at least 60-meter data now because of the size of modern turbines. So the idea here is to collect data for a year to 18 months and then make that data available to wind developers in the hopes we'll find someone, a developer who will come in and put in a wind farm. NREL, National Renewable Energy Lab, thinks that you can have a 50 megawatt wind farm here. And again, it's going to benefit, the site benefits from unused or available transmission. And actually here, the Northwest Power Company is putting in a natural gas peaking plant very close to the site. So it could be a very good marriage between a peaking plant and intermittent wind generation. Slide 8, please. Back to the idea of offsetting carbon, this is the EPA regional headquarters in Denver, and this is a new building. We moved into it in 2007, and it's a very efficient building, and it has an ENERGY STAR rating of 95, which basically means it outperforms 95% of commercial office space in its class nationwide when adjusted for climate. And yet, as inefficient as this building is, we figured the operations of this building generates enough CO2 to fill up 1.5 blimps every day. So now we have an executive order that's asking us to quantify, asking the federal government to quantify its carbon emissions and come up with plans for decreasing that. And while there's certainly some more things we can do with respect to energy efficiency, we're really looking at the idea of putting renewable energy on some of our Superfund controlled sites as maybe a way to do that. Slide 9. Here's the Gilt Edge mine in South Dakota near Deadwood, South Dakota. It's at the top of the Black Hills, again, according to NREL, in a very high wind regime. We just let a contract a few months ago to do additional engineering at the site in support of a wind project. So we've chosen an optimum location for a turbine. We've got some designs on a turbine foundation, the requirements for a hookup, switches, cutoffs, transformers, and the like, as well as some turbine recommendations. But the idea here would be to take all this information we're gathering in the engineering study, package it into an RFP, and see if we can get a third party to come in, build the turbine, operate the turbine, and sell electricity back to the site. Here's, again, a site where we're operating a water treatment plant that's treating around 1,500 gallons per minute, and see if they can do that at a site at a price that's somewhat competitive. Here's a place where the region might in fact buy the renewable energy credits from the electricity generated from the turbine in order to offset the price of having wind generated electricity versus what we're currently paying for coal-fired electricity. And then to wrap up, well, impediments to renewable energy on contaminated lands, I'm sure most of you all are all aware with this. Today, we've really had no imperative for life cycle cost analysis, especially with respect to energy, and we've certainly not had a policy imperative to look at the additional costs or externalities associated with coal-fired plants. And that winds up my time. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you, Timothy. And once again, just a reminder, if you answer session, please do put your phone on mute.
H was like 6.
And I do have a question that
is a week period. What are you getting?
Can you, once again, can you all please put your phone on mute? Okay, there's a question that came online, and this is regarding the Anaconda smelter. How much does the 60-meter Met Tower cost to install and operate? How is it paid for when intended to be used at multiple sites? And this is a question from Illinois EPA.
So you're worried about
it.
Did you calibrate it?
We expect to pay around between $40,000 and $45,000 for the incomplete project. So that's purchase of the tower and the anemometers and the data logger, erection of the tower, and then data collection and data analysis by NREL for 18 months. So we expect the total bill on that to be around between $40,000 and $45,000. EPA will own the tower, and as soon as we're done collecting here, we will move it to another site, another contaminated site that we believe has good wind potential. And it was funded from EPA headquarters through Oxford.
Thank you. And once again, we are hearing a lot of background noise. Can you all put your phone on mute? And if your phone does not have a mute button, please press *6.
At 0.7.
Otherwise, we'll all be globally muted.
And when Bill went out,
is there any questions from the phone lines?
It's a 4.2, modern wealth is. And then there was a 6.94. Oh, that's the deep one.
Okay, no questions from the phone.
When Bill went out and did MW14, it was
online. Once again, please, we request you to put your phones on mute. And with that, we move on to our next speaker. Our second speaker is Harry Ball. Harry is the chief of the Superfund Technical Support Section at EPA Region 9 in San Francisco. He manages staff scientists who provide direct technical support.
No, where's MW15? Because that one was 4.2.
I would like to request Kevin or somebody to vocally mute the lines.
On the north side of the fence. Northwest.
Okay, yeah. Harry Ball manages staff scientists who provide direct technical support for Superfund projects in the fields of engineering, hydrogeology, ecology, and radiological, ecological, and human risk. Today he will give us an update on Region 9.
How's everything else going?
Once again, there's a lot of disturbance background. Can somebody, whoever's on talking on the phone, can you put your phone on mute so it's not...
Really?
Okay, I would like to welcome Harry Ball.
To unmute your line, press pound 6.
I'd be the same way, because I haven't done it in so long. Oh, my God. Example, we would knock him out. Like a system to get going.
Hello, Raji?
Yes, come on. Welcome, Harry.
Hi. Someone's talking about their personal life on this line.
Yes, and I've asked Kevin to mute. Once you start talking, he can globally mute the line.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. You should be, I think, let's see, try to slide number 11. Is that right? Yeah. My presentation is a little bit more on the program side in Region 9. I'm going to give a brief summary of what we're doing in Region 9 and talk a little bit about history, some of the current activities that we're involved in, some of the challenges we face, and then a brief look look going forward. So if we go to the next slide. Here in Region 9, you might have heard of our Clean Up, Clean Air initiative. It began as a cross-program initiative between Superfund and Air Divisions. And the focus was to reduce diesel emissions and greenhouse gas emissions at cleanup sites. One of the early products from that effort was the Smart Energy Resources Guide. It was published last year, we think that this SURGE document, we call it the SURGE, continues to be an excellent resource for RPMs on basic technology concepts. So I encourage you, if you want an introduction, a primer, if you will, to take advantage of that website and download that document. Also, early on, we developed and adopted contract languages for both RAC2 consulting-type work and our emergency response contracts that incorporate provisions for clean diesel control technologies and renewable energy evaluations. This type of language can be found in the contracting toolkit on the CLUIN website that I think everybody might know about. Next slide, current activities. The region management is really very supportive of the work on green remediation. Clean diesel is a huge priority for us here in Region 9 due to air quality considerations in our region. And I wanted to mention that RPMs really are our strength and the main assets that we bring to this issue and getting things done. Another thing I wanted to mention is the life cycle analysis that was the subject of a pilot project here in Region 9. You've heard of it, the Romic pilot. You'll hear more about that later on in today's session. So I wanted to give props to Karen Sherman and Steve Armand in our waste division who continue to make a contribution here in developing this decision framework that we all can use going forward. And I just wanted to make sure, to mention that the goal with the life cycle analysis is really to make better informed decisions and not let some abstract tool determine a remedy decision, but to make better, more informed decisions. So moving on to the next slide. Another thing that we did this past year was we developed a cleanups policy that was a joint policy from both Superfund and the Waste Divisions. It incorporates a lot of sustainability concepts. We think that really strengthen our approaches from a kind of a foundational point of view. And the idea here is to drive a preference for the use of practices, strategies, and technologies to support green cleanups and have those kind of separate from the main policy document and have them, we identify a list of those in a compendium document that support the policy and have those be kind of the living document that is revised as time goes forward. Next thing, some of the challenges and considerations that we're struggling with right now is, you know, how do we routinely incorporate green remediation into our existing decision framework? How to move these things into, you know, our RIFS planning, into our ROD decision documents, those kinds of things. How can we best apply green remediation at sites with the existing authorities that we have available? This is a high-level policy-type considerations that headquarters, is, I know, is working on right now, but it's also one that we're struggling with on the regional level. On PRP lead sites, a lot of sites here in Region 9, you know, where we want to incorporate green remediation of the remedy, it doesn't easily translate into action. At these sites, we need to develop a case for implementation amongst the PRPs and drive them forward to making good decisions. Another area of concern or of challenge is figuring out how we incorporate these considerations into our five-year reviews. Right now, I think nationally, and certainly here in Region 9, the focus is on, you know, remedy protectiveness and not so much on remedy optimization. So it's kind of fertile ground, I think, into looking at these sites that are done and trying to optimize their performance today. Moving on to the next slide, I think we're talking about now, you know, moving towards more implementation. Headquarters has given us, well, they've invested heavily and have developed this a green remediation strategy. They're moving to answer policy questions. Headquarters is providing funds for pilot projects, and it's now really up to the regions, I think, to step up to the plate on the implementation. I wanted to mention the Repower partnerships work. I think you'll hear a little bit more about this from Shahid later on. But we're taking advantage of pilot project opportunities with a national IAG with NREL and hope that it leads to a productive relationship here with NREL in our regional office. I wanted to mention cross-program consistency because we all have to be keep that in the background of our minds here. Lisa Jackson made a finding that six green house gases pose a threat to health and welfare of Americans. Many of our other EPA sister programs are working on implementation, air climate change offices. They're all aggressively moving to address this problem. And Superfund, we don't work in a vacuum. Here in Region 9, we're actively involved with our Clean Energy and Climate Change Office on regional energy strategies, and we in Superfund really need to step up and be part of the solution. And finally, some closing thoughts. I just wanted to ask people to think about what we, the headquarters and the regional energy reps, can do to help you. Headquarters has laid out a path forward on the draft green remediation strategy, and you know, they're really pushing forward to answer policy questions, and they're providing tools, technical support, and even funding for pilot projects. The regions are, you know, we're trying to step up to the plate with training and implementation. But I also wanted people to feel free to call and to, you know, email or tell us if we're doing it right or if there's any other support you need. Give us your ideas for how we can do our job better. And so with that, you know, I'll turn it back to Raji, I guess.
Thank you, Harry. And now we will open it up to the phone lines to see if there are any questions on the phone. And any questions online? And so far there are no questions online. So, Harry, if there are some questions coming in later, we'll get back to you. But right now there are no questions. And with that, we will move on to our third speaker. Our third speaker is Karen Sherman. And Karen is an environmental engineer in the RCRA Hazardous Waste Program in Region 9 in San Francisco. Karen has experience in hazardous waste permitting and corrective action. Most recently, she has been active in developing strategies for estimating the environmental footprints of cleanup sites using a life cycle assessment approach. Welcome, Karen.
Thanks, Raji. So I'm going to go ahead and describe the work EPA Region 9 is doing to estimate the environmental footprint. Yeah, can you advance to slide 16, please. 18, thank you. So I'll describe the work EPA Region 9 is doing to estimate the environmental footprint of a corrective action cleanup. And although this pilot study was conducted on a RCRA corrective action site, the principles we used can also be applied to sites in other cleanup programs, such as Superfund, underground storage tanks, or brownfields. And I want to mention that this pilot study is still in its preliminary stages. We're currently working to improve the methodology and update the inputs to the study, and we expect revised results in a couple of months. So just keep in mind that the results that you'll see today are still a work in progress and will likely change with the updated study. And finally, as an introductory here, I want to mention that the initial work on this pilot study was conducted by an intern at EPA, Britta Beckstead, and I then continued and augmented her work with the assistance of others from EPA and leading to the results that I'm presenting today. So we can move to slide 19. So I expect that the listeners on the line here are already familiar with the ideas behind green remediation. In this presentation, I'll describe some metrics and the methodology that we're developing for estimating environmental footprints of cleanups. And these metrics can help to identify areas where a remedy can be improved and can also help to quantify the extent of improvement. Slide 20. So this is an overview of the topics I'll cover. At first, I'll give a brief description of the pilot site. Then I'll spend most of the presentation on how we conducted the pilot study. I'll describe the methodology in which we used a life cycle assessment approach, and then I'll report the results. Following that, time permitting, I'll briefly discuss in general terms how such results may be applied at cleanup sites, and then finally I'll share some thoughts on the usefulness of life cycle assessment principles for estimating environmental footprints at a cleanup site. Slide 21. So a description of the pilot site is Ramic, East Palo Alto in California. It is a hazardous waste treatment facility, and it's on the edge of the San Francisco Bay. The soil and groundwater are contaminated with VOCs, and groundwater is hydraulically connected to the bay, so there's concern that contamination can reach bay waters. The site is now inactive and undergoing closure and corrective action. Slide 22. So there were two main purposes for the pilot study, shown by the stars there. First of all, we wanted to compare the environmental footprints of three alternative remedies at Ramic. Now, the remedy at Ramic had already been selected before we conducted this footprint analysis, so the results did not factor into the remedy decision. However, in retrospect, we had three questions in mind. First of all, is it important, the first one, is it possible to determine the environmental footprints of the alternative remedies? And at Ramic, did we end up selecting the greenest remedy, greenest in quotes? And how important is offsite manufacture for the total environmental footprint? Then the second star there, the second main purpose of the pilot study was to gain the experience necessary to develop a methodology that we could apply to estimate the environmental footprints in general at other sites. And we expect and hope that the observations from this pilot study will contribute to a methodology being developed by EPA headquarters that will be useful for a variety of cleanup programs. Slide 23. So getting back to Ronic itself and the pilot study, we estimated the environmental footprint of three alternative remedies. Alternative three, which is circled in green, is bioremediation, and it's the remedy that was selected for implementation at Ronic, and it's expected to take 10 years. Alternative four is a traditional pump and treat, and we estimated that it would take 40 years. And alternative two is a hybrid combining both bioremediation and pump and treat, and we estimated it would take 30 years. And just by the way, alternative one was a no-action alternative, and we did not consider that in our study. Slide 24. So a little bit more information about the remedy alternatives. Bioremediation will use injections of cheese whey and molasses mixed with fresh water, and these injections will continue four times per year. Pump and treat will involve treatment of groundwater in an air stripper, followed by carbon filters, and discharge of the effluent to the local POTW. Slide 25. So now I'll comment on the methodology that we used in the pilot study. As I mentioned, we used a life cycle assessment approach, and this is life cycle assessment terminology here. We designated our functional unit to be groundwater remediation. We chose our temporal boundary to be the construction and active life of each alternative remedy. And for our system boundary, we identified three levels. We chose or identified level one as on-site activities. Level two would be transportation to and from the site. And level three would be manufacture off-site of materials that are used on-site. Slide 26. So in our pilot study, we looked at about 20 different materials or emissions. And this slide gives you some examples of the sorts of things that we evaluated in terms of resources and energy use, waste generated, and air emissions. Now, we estimated these materials and emissions to the extent possible for the three alternative remedies and for the three levels that I just mentioned, level one, off-site activity, level two, transportation, and level three, I'm sorry, level one, on-site activities, level two, transportation, level three, off-site manufacturing. Slide 27. So to continue the description of the methodology, I wanted to give a little more information about the activities that are in those three levels. Level one included activities occurring within the fence line of the facility. For example, well construction, bioinjection events, groundwater extraction, and groundwater treatment. Slide 28. Level two, transport to and from the site. This included operators traveling to and from the site, materials and equipment transported to the site, and waste transported off-site. And level two also included transportation or transport of fresh water to the site and wastewater away from the site via local utility district pipeline. Slide 29. Finally, level three, off-site manufacture. Now, this included off-site manufacture as well as production of fuels and electricity and processing of waste and wastewater, all occurring off-site. So, for example, for PVC pipe used in the injection and extraction wells, what is the environmental footprint from manufacturing that pipe? What's the environmental footprint from gravel mining, processing diesel fuel in a refinery, processing cheese whey, reactivating spent carbon, treating wastewater. So we compiled information about the off-site footprints for about 15 different materials or support activities. Slide 30. Now, this is a very busy slide, and if that's on purpose, this slide shows all three levels together to illustrate the conceptual model for the pilot study. There's a lot going on here. The rectangle in the middle is level one, on-site activities. The oval outside of that is level two, transportation. and outside of the oval around the edge is off-site manufacturing. You can see that the analysis can get quite elaborate. In this pilot study, we included everything we thought would contribute to the environmental footprint and that we could find data for. And as we gain more experience, we'll identify the materials and activities that may contribute the greatest to the footprint. And as time goes on, we'd like to focus on these contributors and to streamline the methodology for use at other sites. Slide 31. So that was the methodology. So, and now we'll move on to the results. Slide 32. This slide and the next slide illustrate that we first estimated the amounts of materials used and waste generated for the three alternative remedies at Ramic. This shows pounds of PVC and the gallons of diesel fuel required for alternatives 2, 3, and 4, shown in blue, green, and yellow. And as a reminder, it was alternative 3, the bioremediation in the middle bar, that was chosen as the remedy for Ramic. Slide 33. This slide shows pounds of spent carbon and gallons of wastewater generated in the three alternative remedies. And you can see that bioremediation alternative, the one in the middle, will generate zero spent carbon and zero wastewater. Now, once we tallied up the different materials from on-site activities and transportation, we then moved to level 3 of the study to include off-site manufacture, slide 34. And in our pilot study, we extended our analysis to off-site manufacture for three aspects of the environmental footprint: water used, electricity required, and carbon dioxide emitted. Of course, there are a lot of additional aspects to the environmental footprint besides these three, but in the interest of brevity and actually getting the study done, at some point we decided to limit it to these three aspects. Slide 35. So for water, beginning with water use, this slide shows the water used in the three alternative remedies at Ramic when we take into account on-site activities, transportation, and off-site activities. Alternative 3 in the middle, again, that's the bioremediation alternative that we selected at Ramic, and you can see that it had the smallest footprint for water use. The yellow bar on the right, alternative 4, is the pump and treat alternative. That entire bar is due to water required for off-site activities, predominantly electricity production and processing of spent carbon. That's the yellow bar. Slide 36. Now, the left-hand graph on this slide illustrates the results that we would have obtained for water usage if we had ignored off-site activities. So looking at the left-hand graph, you can see that water totals are fairly low. The right-hand graph shows the water usage when we include off-site activities. And the right-hand graph here is the same as the graph that we saw in the previous slide. So you can see that including off-site activities made a big difference for the water footprint for the remedy at Ramic. That is the three remedy alternatives at Ramic. Slide 37. Just to pause here and look at a few issues and nuances that we encountered when we estimated the water footprint. For example, it was clear that there should be a distinction made between water withdrawn and water consumed. Should we also make a distinction between use of potable water versus non-potable water? In this analysis, we combined all water into the same pot, so to speak, as shown in the graphs you just saw. But maybe all types of water are not necessarily equal. We also did not take into consideration groundwater extracted on site or the return of treated wastewater to surface water bodies. And in the improved and updated pilot study, we do plan to refine the analysis to take into account some of these issues. Slide 38. So turning now to electricity, this graph shows the electricity requirements for the three alternative remedies. Alternative 3 in the middle of this graph is bioremediation, again, the alternative that we selected at Ramic, and it has the smallest footprint for electricity use. Now, this graph illustrates the importance of taking into account more than just on-site electricity usage. Focusing now on the two larger bars, alternative 2 on the left and alternative 4 on the right, the lower portion of each bar in blue represents electricity used on-site within the facility line. The middle portion in red represents electricity used in transportation. In this case, that would be electricity used to pump fresh water to the site and wastewater away from the site. The upper portion of each bar in yellow represents electricity required for off-site manufacture and processing. So as you can see, the transportation and off-site activities accounted for about a third of the electricity required for alternatives 2 and 4. And moving to slide 39, where I've expanded out alternative 3 to show that electricity from off-site activities shown in the yellow portion of that bar accounted for virtually all the electricity requirements for that alternative remedy. So evaluating environmental footprints, cleanups, in doing that, we are used to taking into account on-site electricity usage, but this pilot study for ROMIC, at least for ROMIC, we found that taking into account electricity required for off-site activities was also very important. Moving on to slide 40. The final aspect of the environmental footprint we looked at was CO2 emissions. This slide shows CO2 emissions from the three alternative remedies when we take into account the on-site, transportation, and off-site activities. Alternative 3 in the middle has the smallest CO2 footprint. And taking a closer look at what factors contributed to CO2 footprint for each of the alternative remedies, slide 41. This slide shows a breakdown for alternative 4, the pump and treat alternative. CO2 emissions from on-site construction is a nearly invisible slice at the top of the pie. CO2 emissions from transportation is the small red slice. CO2 emissions from production of electricity used on-site is a large yellow portion of the pie. And the dark green portion of the pie on the left-hand side of the pie there represents CO2 emissions from manufacturing of materials and processing of waste off-site. And the majority of this dark green portion is due to reactivation of spent carbon and treatment of wastewater at COTW.
Hey, Stephen.
If we had not included these off-site activities in the analysis, we would have missed the entire green portion of the pie, or about 50% of the carbon footprint, for the pump and treat alternative at ROMIC.
Yes, today.
Slide 42. Now, this slide shows the breakdown of CO2 emissions for alternative 3, the bioremediation alternative. The dark green portion of the pie is for off-site activities, accounts for about 80% of the carbon footprint, and the majority of that green part of the pie is due to production of cheese whey and molasses and production of gasoline and diesel fuel. Slide 42. I'm sorry, is that slide 43 that we're on? Yes. So on slide 43, this is a hybrid alternative, and as you might expect, the distribution of CO2 emissions is alternative between is midway between the two other remedy alternatives. If we had not included off-site activities, we would have missed about two-thirds of the carbon footprint in this case. Now, in the interest of time, I'm going to go ahead and skip past slide 44 and move on to slide 45. Applying results to our cleanup site and cleanup sites in general. As I mentioned, we did not use the results of this pilot study in the remedy decision for ROMIC because that decision had already been made. However, it became quickly apparent to us that in a remedy decision or in optimizing an existing remedy, it could be a challenge to balance the various aspects of the environmental footprint. Slide 46. For example, we may have to balance local effects such as local water resources and on-site emissions of particulates with global effects such as greenhouse gas emissions. In a water-scarce area, we may prefer an alternative which has a smaller water footprint rather than an alternative which has a smaller CO2 footprint, but in a water-rich area, the converse might be true. 547. So we think there will be no simple answers here. Balancing disparate environmental impacts will be specific from site to site. And, of course, the environmental footprint is not the only factor at a cleanup site, but should be seen as one of several balancing factors in remedy decision-making and optimization decisions. And in all cases, the remedy must first meet the threshold criteria, such as protection of human health in the environment. Slide 48. Now, some thoughts, additional thoughts on life cycle assessment principles. We found using a life cycle assessment approach to be very valuable in estimating the environmental footprint at ROMIC. But a reminder, we did not consider this pilot study to be a life cycle assessment per se. A true life cycle assessment would have taken into account a full evaluation of other aspects of the environmental footprint in addition to water use, electricity use, and CO2 emissions. And a true life cycle assessment would also have included an impact assessment. Again, in the interest of time, we'll skip past slide 49 and go to slide 50. Some more thoughts on life cycle assessment principles. It helped us greatly in the conceptual approach to the environmental footprint at ROMIC. We felt like it helped us to use those principles in quantifying on-site and off-site environmental footprints to distinguish between local and global contributions, to compare footprints of the remedial technologies in a more comprehensive way, and to focus our efforts now in reducing the environmental footprint of the remedies selected. Slide 51, I'll skip also, and slide 52. Wrapping up with some key points. First, we found that, yes, it is feasible to estimate the environmental footprint of a cleanup remedy. We thought we were going to be determining the environmental footprint as we started out, but it's clear to us that we aren't determining anything. We are estimating, given all the assumptions and so forth that we made in the analysis. Second, we found that it's important to include off-site manufacturing when estimating the environmental footprint. And finally, we think that a streamlined version of this methodology would be helpful in conducting footprint analyses at other sites. And, of course, we see that there's no need to conduct a footprint analysis at every cleanup site. However, a streamlined approach at selected cleanup sites could be a valuable tool for quantifying the environmental footprints of our cleanups and then reducing those footprints. So slide 53. To close out and turn it back to Raji.
Thank you, Karen. And we have a few questions online, and I'll ask those, and then I'll ask the phone lines as well. But right now, a couple of questions are related, and one is what model or software was used to estimate the impact of each process material, and is it publicly available? And a related question is, what database did you use to estimate the level 3 impacts?
Okay, yeah, thanks. We did not use software per se for this analysis. We developed an array of spreadsheets in Excel. So it was kind of a homegrown product here. We didn't use any software that's publicly available. It's not publicly, the spreadsheets themselves are not yet available publicly. We feel like they're still in such a preliminary stage that it wouldn't be very useful to put them out there. But in the improvements that we're making to this analysis, we are developing much more kind of user-friendly spreadsheets, shall we say, and those spreadsheets will be made public, or that's our intention at least. In a couple of months when the improved and revised study is completed, and once it goes through all of our internal review, that our intention is to make those publicly available. Now, of course, they're going to be specific to ROMIC. They're not kind of a black box sort of calculator. So if anybody has a site out there that's exactly like Ronak, all they would need to do is shift around the inputs and they would have their results. Any other technology or permutations, they would have to start altering the spreadsheets. And then the second question, where did we get our data? We used a variety of sources. Some of them are EPA studies that came up with, for example, CO2 emissions from producing diesel and gasoline fuel. Some of them are local, sort of like air districts here have data on emissions. I used the Carnegie Mellon input-output model for some of the data. And the National Energy Technology Lab, I used some of their data. We found some information in journal articles. And then some of the information we just did back-of-the-envelope calculations. This is why we feel like it's so important to improve and revise the study, because we feel like our data inputs can be improved greatly, and that's one of the things we're going to be doing in the revised study.
Thanks, Karen. Are there any questions on the phone? Okay, no questions on the phone. I have some more. We can take a few more questions online. And one of the questions is, why was extracted groundwater omitted? Wouldn't this be considered a natural resource deserving of conservation, just like energy?
Yes, it definitely is, and I think should be considered a natural resource. We didn't include it because we weren't along those lines for the first iteration of the study, and we definitely are including it in the improved study. So we're taking into account groundwater extracted. As an aside, the groundwater at Ronak is brackish. It's in connection with the saltwater body of the San Francisco Bay. So it's technically not a drinking water source, but or in practice it's not a drinking water source, but still we do intend to take it into consideration in the revised study.
Thank you. And one more question online. Could you please explain the off-site water usage differences between treatment processes? I can't figure out why so much more water was used in making wells for pump and treat versus wells for bioremediation.
Yes. The water usage is so high for the pump and treat alternative due to electricity production. So the pump and treat alternative had high electricity use, and that electricity use, a great deal of water is required to generate electricity. So that was a large part of the water footprint for the pump and treat. Again, having to do with electricity generation for the pump and treat alternative, that requires a lot of water. And another large part of the water, I don't remember any the other contributors to that water footprint. If the questioner would like to contact me offline, I can certainly go into the details. But electricity production definitely takes up a lot of, requires a lot of water. And actually, it is coming to mind, the carbon regeneration process also takes a lot of water. So that was another large contributor to the water footprint of the pump and treat remedy.
Yeah. Are there any questions on the phone? Okay, if not, I'll have one more question from online. And the rest of the questions, Karen, there are a few more questions that came in, and I will email those to you with the contact information so you can give them the answers offline.
Okay.
So one of the questions is, was O&M and monitoring considered in the pilot footprint evaluation for Ronak?
O&M was considered in the sense that the ongoing groundwater extraction and treatment was a large part of the footprint. Long-term monitoring was not included in our study, but it will be included in the improved revised study. So we did not, we did take into account the operators coming on site to take groundwater monitoring samples. So we included that in the transportation part of the analysis. We did not include in the analysis the footprint from analyzing those samples. Now, in the revised version, we will take into account the footprint from analyzing the samples, which our preliminary kind of look at that, to our surprise, might end up being not a significant part, maybe, of the footprint, but big enough that it's something that we should be taking into account. So we're looking into that for the revised study.
Thanks, Karen. And there are a few more questions. Like I said, I will email those to you. And everybody else, if you have any questions, please go ahead and email those to Karen directly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. And with that, we will move on to our next speaker. Our next speaker is Greg Fife. Greg has been an EPA on-scene coordinator in Region 6 in Dallas for more than 22 years. He has worked on a wide variety of sites and responses. He has been the eclectic OSCE. He has had some of the biggest and most complex removal actions and emergency responses. The sites include wood treaters, residential lead, radiation laboratories, pesticides in homes, massive drum sites, mad scientist labs, hurricanes, tornadoes, etc. Greg is now responding to the region's first vapor intrusion removal action at Del Fasco. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you. After all those hard things, Del Fasco is the typical vapor intrusion site. It's in Grand Prairie, Texas, just right here in the Metroplex, within sight of the Dallas office. It's purely vapor intrusion. Going through a lot of RCRA enforcement actions right now. They're taking actions against the company. The company, Del Fasco, or full name is Delaware Forge and Steel Company. That I'm on page 55 right now. And what they did, they made practice bombs for DOD. And that business did real good for a long time. They actually outgrew their facility, and so they moved it some miles away. And that facility is now an auto shop. Problem with it being a real good facility or business, now that there's a war going on, they don't need the practice bombs or the dummy bombs. And they've run into some financial troubles. Moving on to actually page 57. Del Fasco used trichloroethylene in the process, degreasing, cleaning up the bombs themselves. Over the years, spills and releases, poor housekeeping, that kind of stuff led to the contamination of the groundwater. And, of course, they're right next to a residential area from the north and south. The groundwater plume is heading in that northeast direction. If you look on the next page on 58, you'll see the site in the very left-hand bottom corner is the Del Fasco site. All the other area is residential area. There's a couple other businesses right there on the southern portion of the site. Small homes, lower income homes, fairly well kept older neighborhood. 59, you'll see the outline of the forge itself for the facility. And just from the, the few little spills is what contributed to it. On page 60, you'll see where they've done some groundwater investigation, and the red cores where it exceeded the standards for the groundwater. They found it in places and correlated and extended it on out with the other isoplast there. You can see it's the red is a few blocks, a few blocks to the east, and extended that to that next main road up to Reinhardt Street. to the north. The RECRA program on slide 61 did some indoor air sampling. If you hopefully you have color, the red indicates where they had the hits up in the homes above the action levels. The kind of pink colors are right at the level or at least level of concern. And then they had a whole lot of non-hits there with the green slides and such. So it's fairly well limited, and if you'll want to compare it to the previous slide with the groundwater, it very much lays on top of that and shows or it correlates very, very well. On page 62, shows a little bit more. The state of Texas, the Texas Health Department, did further investigation at the site, taking air samples as well as blood and urine samples. And the blood and urine actually correlated very well with what we saw. Actually, none level exceeded level of concern, but they added a few more houses. They were able to do a few more homes that the RECRA program could not get access to. So, but it stayed right in there with the on the same overlay.
Hey, Dad.
The we went in to try and better define, and this is prior to the state sampling. We wanted to go in and try and get a better handle on the vapor problem. Using these little passive soil gas we used, in this case they were from Beacon, there are others from Gore-Tex and such. They're semi-quantitative, they're in the ground, they stayed in for, here close to 2 weeks, and the, sample itself all the way to, the analysis is about $18 a sample. That doesn't include a little bit of time to, put a hole, about a 2 foot hole, in the ground and cover it, move on, and then retrieve them the 2 weeks later. The you'll see, going back to that same map on slide 64, we put in some 100 points there in that neighborhood. We did the trip lines, the duplicates, things like that. It took about a day to install, and instead of a day to retrieve, it took only one morning. To actually pick them up, get them sent off, package them up, and then we had an 8-day turnaround from the analysis to when they produced the match for us. You'll see just what we did. We went down the right-of-ways on the streets in those four streets from 28th Street down to 31st and up to Reinhardt and beyond where we knew the plume existed. And if you look on page slide 65, the really, the only hot spots that we got that appeared is right there and overlays the two homes that were originally found above the action levels. This kind of looks like a butterfly. There was one spot that didn't get retrieved. So it's a little, in actuality, it would look more like a typical plume with that kind of correction. But what we had was a very, very limited plume where it was coming up into the homes. Going on page 67 is where we get into the remedy and where this really comes into agreement remediation. Most of the homes there were pier and beam construction. You know, with the small crawl spaces, there were no basements. A few of the homes had slab foundations, but the only ones that we dealt with out of the, it turned out to be right out of a dozen homes that, we, did the work on. We chose to do the commercially available exhaust fans. Now that's opposed to a radon type fan, which is typically used, to do this, for, several reasons. And it really comes down to the, abilities and capabilities of the fans and as well as the cost and the installation of it. The rate on page 68, slide 68, you'll see a fan comparison. A typical radon fan, you can get them higher than this, but for something of this size, the radon fan can move 60 to 90 cubic feet per minute at a cost of $1,500 per unit, and that's the cost of the unit, no installation involved there. The crawl space fan that we selected, or that's typically available from the Home Depot's, Lowe's, and things like that, it runs at 200 cubic feet per minute, and they can go up to about $200 per unit. And that just, you know, with the volume of air that can move with the cost per unit and with the here in Beaton homes we had, that's really, it made all the sense in the world to go this way with it. Looking at page 69, gives a typical cost of what the electrical cost would be. And running, you know, the entire time, the electric cost would be about $3 to $8 a month. Variation there is not so much the electrical cost or the electrical use as much as it is the cost. Depending on the plan the people have, whether they are limited, have a smaller use, or whether they have something bigger than that, or their actual use itself, it can be up to $3 to $8 a month just for electrical use. If you go to page 70, just did a comparison there on what it looks like for a price of gasoline. That $8 per month can be $96 a year. Comparing it to what people drive, the federal standard of 15,000 miles a year, average mile per gallon is 21, and that's according to DOT records. That's 714 gallons a year. And that $96 then equates to about a variation of 13.5 cents per gallon of gasoline. So it's not that huge of impact to the pocketbooks of the residents, but that's where we really got involved in choosing the option we did, going to the solar power. These people don't see it as their problem. There are lower incomes, and you know, $100 a year can make an impact to them. You know, they want somebody to pay. My program, the emergency response program or removal program, we cannot get into the operation maintenance there, so I have to really come up with something that we could do rather than paying for electricity and from here until there is a more permanent solution to the vapor plume. And what we did, we looked at on page 71, going to that solar power exhaust fan. It's typically the fan is about the same size, has the same capacity, the 200 feet cubic feet per minute, as the commercially available, you know, plug-in exhaust fans. The panel itself will put out the 10 watts. That size of it, if you look at it, it's about 3/4 inch thick. And when you compare it, it's just about the size of two pieces of paper side by side. And, you know, that makes up the whole process. This system, just commercially available off the shelf, it runs about $200 for the entire unit. You know, add in a quarter's worth of wiring. We did make a modification on the systems themselves. We end up going and putting a battery in the system, and it's just a small battery. It was a $22.50 battery just to keep it running 24 hours a day, or at least extending the time period that fan would run. We got good results on using the fan, as you can see on page 72. One of the homes, and it's the highest home we had, it reduced the order of magnitude, and it took it right to the action level. And we wanted to do a little bit better than that at the action level, and that's what drove us to put the battery on. The second home, according to the slide, it took it 2 orders of magnitude. And we actually, of the other 10 homes that we did on this site, we had right at the two orders of magnitude at all each of the homes. Some they were on the perimeter and they did not exceed the action level to start with, but because they were right there, the plume was going to move. And but the simple little fan took care of that. Adding the battery to the first home got us to about that second order of magnitude as well. On page 73, you can see the installation that it took. The upper right, the upper left photo is the solar panel just mounted, the homemade brackets. The Christmas lights were not part of the installation. This was taken in June, so but now it's kind of time appropriate now. But the those are Christmas lights, not the wire to the system. The right-hand photo is the vent that we had to put in. A lot of these homes were affected that they had vents, crawlspace vents that were either closed up or, in this case, they did not exist in the home. And you can see the plaster and the paint that's drying from the wire leading on up to the house that disappeared as the paint dried. But, you know, we looked at it for both the green remediation as well as avoiding the calls to the residents for that. I'll give it back to Raji.
Thank you, Greg. Are there any questions on the phone? Okay. And so far I don't see any questions online. And so we'll just any more questions on the phone? Okay, then we will move on to our fifth and final speaker. And our speaker is Shahid Mahmood. Shahid is the team leader for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Abandoned Mine Lands Team and the co-chairperson of EPA's National Mining Team and National Lead Sites Workgroup at EPA headquarters. He has over 18 years of experience with EPA in developing regulations and policies on environmental control and remediation of waste sites in EPA's solid waste and Superfund programs. Shahid's areas of expertise include developing policies and guidance on mining and lead contaminated sites, Superfund remedy selection process, managing and implementing regulatory programs, and coordinating large projects between federal, state, and industry stakeholders. Welcome, Shahid. Shahid? Okay. Looks like he is running a little bit late because he just called me a few minutes ago. And so while we are waiting for Shahid to get on, what I can do is, Karen, are you still on?
Yes, I'm still here.
Should I go through some of the other questions I didn't get a chance to ask?
That's fine.
Okay. The next question I had here is, go back to Karen's presentation while we're waiting for Shahid. And the first question I had here is the data input library available to the public, and where can it be accessed? And I believe you touched upon this earlier, but again, this was another question that was asked.
Yeah, that's fine. The data library that we use is still under construction with improvement and revisions to the study, but once we have it complete and the study is kind of made public, yes, that data library will be available to the public. And in fact, that's one of our main goals here in finishing up the pilot study and making it more thorough and complete is to make that available to the public so on the one hand they can critique it and help us improve it for future pilot studies, and on the other hand hopefully they can use anything that they see as useful or valuable on their own projects. So we definitely do want to get our methodology and our inputs essentially out there to the public for both those reasons. Again, I'm not quite sure when that will be. Hopefully the revised study will be
completed in a couple of months, and then there may be some internal review and so forth, but at some point the goal is to have all that information public.
Okay, and then it also, the next question was, how long did the analysis take?
Yeah, it took a long time. It actually, we started it a year and a half ago in the summer with our summer intern, and we finished it in about 6 months giving the results that I showed today. Then it's kind of been sitting there waiting for improvements, and we began the improvements in September of this year, and so it's been a couple, like 3 or 4 months that we've been working on the improving and revising it. So it seemed like a large effort. One of the things that we're aware of is that this is not realistic for any site, really, or most sites, and that's where I do want to emphasize the reason we're doing such a thorough study is to hopefully weed out all of the aspects that, of a remedy that typically will not contribute a large amount to an environmental footprint and therefore have a more streamlined version that we can offer to the outside once we have weeded out all of these small, minor parts and contributors.
Thank you. The next question is, what portion of this, if any, has been incorporated into the sustainable remediation tool version 2?
I think the questioner is referring to the APSI, the Air Force tool. And if that's what the questioner is referring to, then none of it has been. I'm aware of how that tool works, but it was developed separately from ours, and again, we don't really consider this ours to be this analysis to be a tool, but rather it's an array of spreadsheets that really are fairly labor intensive to work with. And again, we hope to streamline it so that it's much more streamlined and much more easy to work with in the final kind of final product. But no, we didn't use the SRT, and nor did the SRT use anything that we did in their tool, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah. And the next one is, how easy would it be to convert your analysis into a greenhouse gas reporting format of scope 1, scope 2, scope 3 emissions?
I don't know exactly. Mike Gill is giving me some cheat notes here. No, yeah, I know, for CO2 equivalents. Oh, okay. Our original study, the one I presented today, it looks only at CO2 emissions, and the revised version will look at other greenhouse gases and will report CO2 equivalents. But I'm not sure how easily it would be to convert it to the scope 1, scope 2, scope 3. That questioner would like to email me. We can go offline and talk a little bit about what exactly is the interest is there.
And then I'll email you the questioner's information as well, and the questioner can also email you.
Okay.
And the last question for you is, for ROMIC, did you establish weighting of the metrics? If so, could you give us some idea of your basis for the weighting?
Any combining or weighting of the method, of the metrics, of the different aspects of the environmental footprint? The most we did is we kind of had a chart that showed green for good, yellow for bad, and red for even worse in terms of how big the footprint was for each aspect of the environmental footprint. So, for example, water use was high for one of the alternatives but low for the others and so forth. We have not yet gotten into actually doing sort of a weighting scheme, and we don't know whether we will or not. On the one hand, you're comparing such different things when you're looking at water use and electricity use and CO2 emissions and waste generation and others that will be evaluated in the improved study. They're just so different that it's hard to see how you can combine them together in kind of one score. But we are keeping an open mind, and we're just trying to look at what the best way is to look at the results in total, and it's kind of still a work in progress. But, no, we didn't do that for this part of the study.
Okay. Thank you, Karen. And while you were talking, I did get a couple of questions for Greg Five's presentation, and we'll take those questions, and then we'll move on to Shahid. So, again, the questions that the question for Greg is, how is the EPA ensuring the operation of the fans, and is there an O&M program?
Yeah, the first of all, there is no O&M program. We're prohibited from the statute from doing that in our program, but that doesn't mean they're left out there. The RECRA program is still pursuing the PRPs. They do have money. There is money that has been set aside under a settlement, and they are continuing to watch and do that. If there is a problem, we are able to go back and do repairs. We can't do an O&M system, but for the next several years, probably, it's going to be either watched or monitored, as well as there's some definite solution that they're seeking with the company itself.
Yes. Thanks, Greg. And then the next question is, where did the solar panels come from for the crawl space fans?
Okay, they are commercially available in a lot of different places. The vendor we used is out of Weatherford, Texas. Weatherford is, the company is EcoVantage, and it's just EcoVantage out of Weatherford. And there are others. They sell that exact same model. I forget the manufacturer of the model itself, but it's pretty commercially available. And Home Depot and Lowe's have a similar model to it. They're made more for attics, and we wanted to be able to set the panel off to the side to get the best view.
Okay. Thanks, Greg. And now we will go back to our Shahid's presentation. I know he's trying to get online. And I'm just going to put you all on hold for a second because I just got a note. Just a second. Okay, Shahid, are you on? Okay, while he's just calling in, and while he's calling in, I will, because of all the interruptions, what I will do is I will go ahead and give a quick introduction of Shahid. He's, again, the team leader for the Environmental Protection Agency Abandoned Mine Lands Team and the co-chairperson of EPA's National Mining Team and National Lead Sites Workgroup in EPA headquarters. He has over 18 years of experience with EPA in developing regulations and policies on environmental control and remediation of waste sites in EPA's solid waste and Superfund programs. Shahid's area of expertise include developing policies and guidance on mining and lead-contaminated sites, Superfund remedy selection process, managing and implementing regulatory programs, and coordinating large projects between federal, state, and industry stakeholders. And today he will be talking on the potential of renewable energy on contaminated lands and mining sites. So Shahid, welcome Shahid, and you're on.
Hi Raji, I'm going on the green remediation webinar, and I don't have the presentation up. Do you? I'm just trying to find that presentation.
Okay. Yes, if you click on today's seminar, go to seminar,
you should be able to get your presentation.
It has renewable energy on contaminated lands in Region 8. That's what shows up.
So that's the first. Go to slide 74.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. There we are. Sorry. Technical glitch. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you, Raji, for the wonderful introduction there. As Raji said, I'm just going to be talking a little bit about, give a little bit of background on the Repower initiative that EPA embarked on last year on siting renewable energy on contaminated lands and mining sites. I'll go ahead and jump to the next slide. Basically, we launched this effort last year in the Brownfields Conference, and we have taken a four-prong or maybe a multi-prong approach under this initiative. First of all, we work with the Department of Energy, National Renewable Energy Lab, to do mapping of high-potential solar and wind as well as biofuels on contaminated lands and mining sites. So we did that last year, and we've updated it just, if you are interested, we've updated that and we've added geothermal and also added more sites. Just today it was announced, and I got a note from Laura Matthews, who's in our Center for Program Analysis. So that's live, so you can go to that website, and I'll give you that address at the end. We've also been conducting a series of outreach activities with various solar, wind, as well as developers and financiers on trying to find out what the concerns may be, what the barriers may be, and what might be some incentives to site these types of projects on these types of sites. Thirdly, we've also been working with NREL, which is the National Renewable Energy Lab, and we've awarded 13 pilot sites, pilot studies, where NREL will go and work with the regions to do an economic and technical feasibility of siting on these 13 sites, as well as other pilots that we've been engaged with in the past. And then fourthly, we're, through our discussions and talking with the various stakeholders, we're trying to get solicit feedback on, we've developed some tools under the Mine Scarred Lands Initiative under Brownfields and under Superfund tools on liability protections for people trying to do these types of projects. But we're also trying to hear if there's any specific related liability concerns for siting renewable energy on these lands. So that's as a backdrop. I just wanted to just give that as a background and go over what I'm going to be covering during this presentation. If we could jump to the next slide, just going back again, why we thought about embarking in that project is basically we thought that there were, you know, we've got a lot of land that's out there that have been formally contaminated that have been addressed either in the brownfields, RECRA, or Superfund programs, and we think that in reaching out and talking to communities that there may be, because of the economic situation in those properties, that most of them are sitting idle and on the tax rolls, that there may be some less of a opposition, sort of not in my backyard syndrome. We've talked to a couple of times to the Summit of Mining Communities that we've had meetings at, and most of them are looking for, you know, opportunities for economics or to bring jobs into the community, so they may have less of an opposition. That's what, you know, just anecdotal information of what we're hearing when we've done these outreach activities. Secondly, for the mining sites, at least, and that's what I work on in particular, because the mining operations had a large amount of electrical needs, so you have existing electrical transmission, high-capacity transmission lines available at these sites, and you also have some other associated infrastructure like water, in some cases, buildings and roads. So basically, you have that kind of an opportunity at these sites, as well as most of these sites were zoned as industrial operations, so the zoning part of it may be a little bit more agreeable to developers. And basically, we don't have to carve out new lands and put in new capital. Maybe need to modify some. Maybe some cost savings realized from that type of an operation as well. But in all these points that I'm trying to make is that if we're going to be putting up green projects, renewable energy projects, it makes sense to not carve out green lands and take away the carbon sequestration effects or carbon sink effects of trees and vegetation, and to maybe try to develop these on brown lands that are kind of sitting idle and may have an existing infrastructure. So that's the overall point that we're trying to make. If you could go to the next slide. Again, you know, we are trying to reduce
the... Which slide are you on, if you announce the slide
number? I'm sorry, 77, sorry. Okay? So what we're saying is we're trying to lower the transaction costs as compared to if you were to do just a whole infrastructure build-out on greenfield sites. It may be some significant cost, so you may be able to save some costs doing it on brownfield sites or, you know, formerly contaminated property. And you may have some local or state types of incentives also available to do this kind of an activity on brownfields properties. Next slide, which is number 78, kind of quickly going through this because I know I'm kind of running late for, I think it could be done at 3 o'clock. The next slide was number 78, and basically when we mapped our sites, we discovered there's about 16 million acres that are potentially available. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to be all of them are developable, because you may have some contamination that you're still addressing, or you may have slope factors, you know, you're very, you know, very steep terrain that you may not be able to develop some sort of properties, but you know, this is basically a gross mapping that we did, and basically we would have to go down to the local level and, you know, if you were to do, say, for instance, a wind development, you might have to do an anemometer study for a year at that site to see what kind of wind potential you have. So you would have to do some studies on the ground, and you would have to do that on greenfields anyway, but on this in this particular area, you would have to do it on the ground to see the feasibility and how you would design your wind farm. So basically, we have this potential acreage available, of which 850,000 acres have been sort of been addressed under Superfund and other programs. So we do have that track of land or tracts of lands available that may be developable by putting renewable energy facilities on them. And again, another benefit would be, you know, you would, as I said, NIMBY, basically people may be wanting to embrace this because it may create some local job opportunities and other tax revenues for the local governments. So that was number 78. I just wanted to move on to the next slide and just talk a little bit about the mapping effort that was done. It was a very successful venture between EPA and the National Renewable Energy Lab, where we had provided data on our sites, and they were able to use the maps, and I think a lot of folks have seen those NREL maps, and they have mapped those over our sites, and it shows the opportunities of where these might be available. Now, these are maps that are at the 30,000-foot level. So, again, you may have to do site-specific studies in those lands to make a determination whether a project would be feasible or not going forward. And we also, as part of this effort, produced some state incentive fact sheets on what may be available by states on developing on contaminated lands with these renewable energy projects. So that's just a quick thumbnail sketch of what we did under the Google Earth mapping. Next slide, I just wanted to show you that this is basically slide number 80. I don't have an interactive map, so we just took some shots of where the distribution is. And these are, if you see these sites, the red ones, the red dots are RCRA, the yellow ones are abandoned sites, the pinkish or whatever that color is, I guess it's like lilac, colors like brownfield sites. So we did all these. These were the points on the map that that are EPA tracked properties, and we laid the solar and wind potential on top of that, as well as the and now we've added the geothermal. If we go to the next slide, I just wanted to bring out, and since I do mining, I just wanted to This is the next slide on the Summitville mine. If you click on one of those dots, and since I don't have an interactive map, I'm sorry, I just sort of had a snapshot over here. If you pressed on this yellow dot in Colorado and in Rio Grande County, this is the type of information that would be pulled up. And in this one, it shows you where is it located, what's the acreage of that property, what the potential is for renewable energy, for wind, as well as solar. So if you look down here, the wind power class is 8, and it's supposed to be basically at the 50 meter, 400 to 500, and then basically would be a good wind potential. And for the solar, we're looking at about 7 kilowatt hours per meter squared per day, and that's considered an excellent potential. So if a developer were to be interested in that part of the country, that it has a pretty good potential, and this is one of the sites I'll talk about a little later that we're trying to work with the Bureau of Land Management and Forest Service on, because these are mixed ownership mining sites under the 1872 mining law, where we have private ownership as well as federal ownership. So we're trying to look for opportunities to leverage resources to work on these types of sites to see how we what track may be most attractive. So that's a Summitville site, and if you go down there, the first, I guess, link, EPA cleanup program information, you could press on that. That'll give you to the Superfund fact sheet on that site showing you what kind of actions have been taken and what's available. If you go to the next site, this is just another site up in the Anaconda Mineral site up in Montana. This also has a pretty good potential for wind, as well as a good potential, outstanding for wind and a good potential for solar. So these are the types of, when you press on those buttons, this type of information will come up. And I don't want to mislead most people. I mean, not all of them will have this type of in-depth information on where the site's at. The Superfund sites, where we've studied them more, and when you go to the EPA Cleanup Program Initiative link, you will have far more data. For the brownfields, there might be less data, and for RCRA, there may be other kind of data that's available. So you'll have it based on the type of programs and the robustness or non-robustness of the data based on which button you push. And some sites, even for under Superfund, may be in the early study phase, so basically you may not have as much data on that. So if we go to the next one, we also provided, North Carolina State University does a lot of a combing of information on grants and incentives that are available from states. So we've used their database and other NREL information to develop state and federal incentive fact sheets, which is also part of this website. And I'll go on to the next one, just sort of show you, and I'm sorry about the small writing. This is a state incentive fact sheet for the state of New Mexico, and it goes into what kind of tax incentives that you have, and basically the solar thermal tax credits, what kind of assistance, technical assistance are available, what kind of net metering type of agreements are there, and what kind of funding sources may be there. And so, and there's also like a limitation on liability. So each state would have, we have a sheet on each state to lay out what kind of incentives and breaks that you may have and what kind of agreements you may be able to get, as well as what kind of assistance you might be able to obtain from that state in terms of both technical and legal in terms of liability relief. So that's basically, I just wanted to show a snapshot of the New Mexico, but we have these state incentive fact sheets for all 50 states. So that was just the Google Earth effort, and I'll quickly go through the other set of efforts. We've been going out on the road to a lot of conferences and talking about and to launch this initiative. We've gone to the various wind and solar conferences that have been held over the last couple of years. And as I mentioned before, we've gone to the Summit of Mining Communities Conference over the last 2 years. We just went to the Brownfields Conference in New Orleans just about a couple, two, 3 weeks ago, and we, as we, you know, talked about this as well. Personally, also gone to the Mine Exposition Conference as well as the Northwest Mining Association conferences. And basically, we're trying to reach out and trying to get feedback from folks to see if there's any other assistance that's needed, if there's any barriers that they see, if there's other things that we can help with, to the extent EPA can help with it. I mean, we can't help with too much funding because, you know, DOE's got a lot of the funds, but we could put some seed money in perhaps. But at the end of the day, you know, the project would have to stand on its own merit and its own economics. Maybe we can facilitate in that case, to bringing different groups together. We've also started in, the American, it's actually the Association of State, Solid Waste, Management Organization, State, and Territory Solid Waste Management, ASWOMO, subcommittee on this, particular topic. We've also engaged, with Region 9 on a lot of efforts, where BLM in Arizona has some stimulus money to do some studies on siting some of these renewable energy facilities in the state of Arizona. And we've also started with a stakeholder dialogue process to try to get input from the various, whether they be financiers, whether they be developers, whether they be suppliers, whether they be local entities and governments and basic stakeholders and landowners to talk about if there's issues and how EPA can help with those issues, and then also to learn from them who else EPA should be working with to bring other folks to the table. So we've had one in Detroit back in October. We just did one in New Orleans in November, and the series of a couple of more meetings coming up, stakeholder dialogues coming up in LA and Atlanta in January. The next slide, which is 86, I just wanted to highlight some of the pilot sites and projects that I've worked on, and I'll just highlight the Summitville one since the map came up. We're doing a micro hydroelectric power plant there where there's going to be this project, when it's built, it's going to be probably built by the end of this year. It's going to supply the power for all the pump and treat system that's going to be needed. It's an acid mine drainage treatment system, and so the electrical needs for the system is going to be offset. And I think the return on investment on this, and I don't know, Tim Rader, if he's on the phone, was something between 7 to 9 years on this. And this is going to be one of those plants that's going to be, you know, acid mine drainage is going to be operating for a very, very, very long time. Another project that we engaged with in Region 8 was the Anaconda site, where we did some detailed analysis and studies, a feasibility type of a report, and gave it to the county government, who sent out an RFP, a request for proposal. They have a developer who's very interested in developing a wind farm out there, as much as a 50-megawatt wind project. And at this current stage, we've got a couple of anemometers up there and trying to get the data for the next year or so to see what kind of configuration that wind farm's going to take. And then another one is the Molly Core site. We're working with Chevron, which is the site owner, to look at the feasibility in New Mexico for siting a solar PV facility. I think we're talking about 1 megawatt. It's only a 30-acre parcel right now, but that may expand. It's a very big mining site, so it may expand in the future. So just a quick highlight on some of the pilot sites that we're trying to engage in and to learn from and to get some feedback on and to provide some technical assistance. If we turn to the next slide, again, as I had said in my first slide, it's a multi-pronged approach, working with NREL, doing the mapping, updating the mapping, and then basically doing on-site engagement and outreach type of activities. The fourth prong, I guess, if you want to call it that, is trying to develop tools to encourage the reuse of these impaired lands. Now, we already have a lot of existing tools where we've done comfort and status letters for developers who want to develop on Superfund sites. Now, that could be a Home Depot. It could be a golf facility, or it could be some other type of a use, but we haven't done one, and perhaps we're trying to look for from these pilots if there is a need for a letter that would have something on renewable energy. We've also done, under the Superfund program, a ready for reuse determination certificates that we produce for various sites, saying that this parcel is ready for reuse for these types of purposes, whether it be commercial, industrial, or residential, or recreational. So we've done that in that the website or the link. You can go to that to find out more on that guidance. And we've done this all over the United States for the various regions. We also have developed site reuse profiles in some of the regions, like Region 4, to give a little bit of a history and background of the sites, what the environmental concerns are, and where are we in the cleanup status and the reuse status of those sites. An additional tool is just the partial deletions. We've carved out portions of sites from the NPL that have been cleaned up. So that may be, palatable for some of the developers saying that this is not part of the NPL sites. Maybe we could do a deletion. And, we've done other agreements that, we've done through a consent decree or a covenant not to sue through DOJ. For instance, we've done one, a mining site in Utah, where we've carved out an 18-acre parcel and provided a 999-year lease for a luxury spa facility that they will develop. And we've been given a covenant not to sue all the way up to DOJ for them to use it for that particular purpose. Now, whatever waste that they dig up and create would be put into the mining sites, which is a bigger, much broader area, which they would be, responsible for stormwater control and other construction activities. But if they're doing due diligence and following all sorts of the work plan that's been laid out, then they would be covered under this covenant not to sue. So we could do that type of an agreement as well. And additionally, we just sort of laid out all these other types of handbooks and fact sheets and guidances that are available from the different programs. So if you're so inclined after this meeting to, look up on these sites, so you have a lot of tools that we can kind of look at to provide some level of comfort for developers and maybe their financiers as well for these tools. If we go to the next slide, which is 88, and I'm going to fly through these really quickly because of the time constraints here, we're also looking at partnering with the various federal and state agencies where they have been working on mapping their zones. For instance, the Western Governors Association is this, and Department of Energy have developed these Western Renewable Energy Zones, or WARA as they call them, that they've said this is how far it is from the transmission line. Now, these are green fields and not necessarily brown fields or contaminated land. So we're trying to make them also think about how we can sort of overlay our brown fields and contaminated properties in those zones. BLM has also developed some solar zone mapping for their lands. And Colorado and California have also been working on some sort of resource mapping efforts as well. And we have sort of taken our repower maps, our contaminated raw properties map, and overlaid those four different types of efforts and to see if there are some collaborative opportunities out there. The next slide, which is 89, this just lays out the Western Governor's zones that they have. They have drawn radiuses and diameters around certain hub zones and said that this may be potential lands that may be amenable for renewable energy because of the transmission, the infrastructure, and the resources that are available. The next one is the one that DOE has developed on the various, types of their facilities as well as BLM facilities that's out there. I'm just quickly going through these. These are just maps. And then this is a summary. What we did is we took our sites, whether they're RCRA, landfills, abandoned mine sites, brownfield sites, and laid it over, the different renewable energy zones and found that there's about 97 sites on our universe, and as you recall, we've got a lot of these sites, that there may be a potential to work with these different agencies to see if there's some collaborative opportunities to see if it lies in a certain renewable energy zone to try to promote developing not on green lands, but on these types of properties. Again, this is the map of those 97 sites that we have done. So these are the potential sites that where we might be able to work with them, and we've engaged with BLM and Forest Service on some of these. And basically, a lot of these sites that we've mapped were longitude, latitude, and we're trying to get shape files because that's what Forest Service and BLM wanted. And we're trying to work with the regions to get the shape files where I think there's about 17 mining sites that I'm working with to see what we can do. And I think we've got like 10 or 12 shape files that we're going to be working further with BLM and Forest Service to see if there's any opportunities for developing on maybe at least a couple of these. Again, this is another map of other sites that we mapped over another set of renewable energy zones. And then finally, again, what we're looking at and going on for the next steps is to that, you know, a lot of people are doing in running out with developing renewable energy and trying to come up with policies and come up with fundings and coming up with that. But we need to just sort of take a step back. You know, we're doing the same thing as well. If there's a way that we can collaborate on a national level, and that's some of the feedback that we've gotten from these stakeholder dialogues, is to see if there is some collaborative opportunities and joint funding that could be done on some of these overlapping sites. And maybe we could sort of work on how we can get these things done. And we've been told that maybe we need to work with other federal agencies as well, just not just the land management agencies such as DOE, because DOE, basically, I mean, they got the mega bucks, so if they can sort of help us out with some of these projects. DOD has a lot of their track lands that, you know, we might be able to engage with them. Department of Commerce has the Economic Development Authority, maybe could be helping out with infrastructure development. And interesting enough, in the last New Orleans stakeholder meeting, somebody brought up the concept of the IRS and maybe a tax code that could give incentive, tax incentives that could be worked with through the IRS to make these projects more palatable. And then, of course, we're trying to collaborate with state organizations such as SWAMO and the Western Governors Association as well to get some more you know, of these projects going. So that's basically quickly running through it. I'm sorry I was kind of late and ran through this. Raji, I'll just turn it back to you with any questions.
Thank you, Shahid. Are there any questions from the phone participants? Tim? And so far, I don't see any questions online. And if any of you have any questions for Shahid or any of the speakers, your email addresses is given on the front page. And also, if you would take a moment to fill out your seminar feedback form, we would really appreciate it. With that, we can close the session, and thank you all the speakers for participating, and thank you all for participating as well. Have a great day. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.